From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from London.
Family wants those who shot dead their son wrongly to be brought to book. And they want to see a full legal process take place. They want someone to pay for it.
The shooting of a Brazilian citizen in the wake of the London bombings last summer is in the news again, with the state visit of Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to London. We'll speak with the leading British TV editor, Deborah Ternis. Then the controversy over the New York production of the play My Name is Rachel Corrie. We'll go to the home of Oscar award-winning actor Vanessa Redgrave.
And this was an extraordinary young girl. It wasn't... She didn't take sides, although she went to defend Palestinians. It isn't about taking sides, it's about defending human life. That's the basis of all human rights. That's the basis of what every country proclaims it stands for.
And on this International Women's Day, Margaret Busby, the youngest and first black woman publisher in Britain, on Daughters of Africa. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Intelligence Committee has voted down a proposal to investigate the Bush administration's domestic spy program. The vote came after the White House and Republican senators agreed to new guidelines for the practice of government eavesdropping without court-approved warrants. According to the New York Times, the deal asks the Bush administration to request court warrants only, quote, whenever possible. The Bush administration would be given a 45-day grace period to spy without court warrant if they felt requesting them would compromise national security. After the 45-day period, the warrantless eavesdropping could then be extended if the Attorney General certifies the administration's stance. In addition, a handful of extra members of Congress would also be briefed on the program's activities. Democrats lashed out at the deal. West Virginia Senator John Rockefeller, who serves as vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said, quote, "The committee is, to put it bluntly, basically under the control of the White House." In other congressional news, the House voted to renew the USA Patriot Act. The measure was approved by a vote of 280 to 138, just two more votes than needed under rules requiring a two-thirds majority. Under the new legislation, the government investigators would still be allowed to obtain library and bookstore records. President Bush is expected to sign the bill before the law's current provisions expire on Friday. While the spy program and Patriot Act votes were seen as major Republican victories, the Bush administration has failed to stave off a challenge to a deal granting a Dubai-owned company management of six U.S. ports. On Tuesday, Republican leaders agreed to hold a vote next week that could cancel the deal. The vote will be attached to legislation funding the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. President Bush has vowed to veto any bill that blocks the port deal. In New York, a battle is brewing at Columbia University over a lecture by DePaul University professor Norman Finkelstein. Finkelstein appeared on Democracy Now! Last month. He's an outspoken proponent of Palestinian rights. Finkelstein's latest book, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history, attracted controversy when Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz attempted to prevent its publication. Demand has been so high for the event, the university changed the location to a venue accommodating 1,500 people. But some student groups, including the College Conservatives and Lion Pack, a group that advocates Israeli government policies, are mobilizing against Finkelstein's lecture. University administrators are reportedly considering several proposals to restrict access to the event. Finkelstein's lecture will take place tonight. More than 6 months after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, two more bodies have been found in New Orleans. The bodies were found in badly damaged areas of the Ninth Ward and in New Orleans East. President Bush is expected to visit the city today. Meanwhile, home demolitions have resumed in the Ninth Ward. On Monday, demolition crews began tearing down the first of close to 120 homes in three low-income districts. In December, local residents had won a temporary order to stop the bulldozing and grant homeowners the right to be notified of pending demolitions. In Houston Tuesday, the government's star witness in the prosecution of two former top Enron executives testified against his former employers. Andrew Fastow, Enron's former chief financial officer, said former CEO Jeffrey Skilling directly told him to inflate company earnings. Fastow also implicated former Enron chair Ken Lay. Both Lay and Fastow are facing multi-year sentences on multiple fraud charges. In Kenya, thousands of people marched in the capital of Nairobi to protest the government's recent crackdown on media groups. The march comes days after government forces raided the headquarters of a local television network and burned thousands of copies of a newspaper published by the same company. This is opposition political activist Sam Ongeri.
The human value has been degraded to such a level that we can no longer tolerate it and accept it.
That was politician Sam Ongeri in Nairobi on Tuesday. In the occupied territories, a senior Palestinian aide has accused Hamas of attempting a coup against Palestinian Authority President Chair Mahmoud Abbas. The statement followed a measure approved by the new Hamas-controlled legislature to cancel a recent decision to grant Abbas wider powers. The aide, Tayeb Abel Rahim, said, quote, "We see this as a coup attempt to change the regime, and they have to seriously reconsider their decisions." But a Hamas spokesperson insisted the new measure was within the bounds of the law. Meanwhile, the Israeli government has accused two prominent human rights groups of undermining the state. In a submission to a Jerusalem court, a state prosecutor said the groups Hamoked and Betzalem, quote, "undermine the existence of the State of Israel and, quote, cause it damage in the world." The statement came in a lawsuit brought by a Palestinian resident of East Jerusalem against the Israeli government for alleged harassment and abuse. The man's lawsuit included a statement from a representative of the group Hamoked, which, along with B'Tselem, documents human rights abuses in the occupied territories. In response to the prosecutor's comments, Hamoked director Dalia Kirstein wrote, quote, "The prosecution document contains unbridled attacks on our organization, on B'Tselem, and on the very notion of defending the human rights of Palestinians. Attacks by the state on human rights organizations active in it and on the sheer legitimacy of their existence pose a serious threat to democratic rule," she said. In Uzbekistan, the government has sentenced a leading human rights activist and two prominent opposition figures to lengthy prison terms. Mokhtabar Tojibayeva, a well-known activist who's led criticism of the Andijan massacre of May 2005, was sentenced to 8 years in prison Monday. Holly Kartner, Europe and Central Asia director at Human Rights Watch, said, quote, "We view the conviction as part of a pattern of persecution against independent voices and critics within civil society since the Andijan massacre. The ferocity of this pattern is unprecedented, even when judged against Uzbekistan's 14-year history of repression since independence from the Soviet Union," she wrote. Also Monday, opposition leader Sanjar Umarov of the Sunshine Coalition of Uzbekistan was sentenced to 14 years in prison. Last week, the group's coordinator was sentenced to a 10-year term. Their sentences were also condemned by Human Rights Watch. In Texas, indicted Congressmember Tom DeLay won his district's Republican nomination Tuesday, escaping a primary challenge from three other candidates. The Houston Chronicle reports DeLay spent the eve of the primary at a fundraiser hosted by two Washington lobbyists. DeLay was forced out of his job as House Majority Leader last year amid corruption and campaign finance scandals. And this update on the case of indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff. A federal judge has rejected a request to delay his sentencing because imprisonment could derail his cooperation in several ongoing criminal investigations. Abramoff was ordered to return for sentencing on March 29th. Abby Lowell, Abramoff's attorney, warned the court he may reveal details of the government's investigations at his client's sentencing. Lowell said, quote, "We will name names. We will provide the public with evidence of what's going on out there. It seems to me that's not in the interests of law enforcement," he said. In other news, civil rights advocate Ann Braden has died at the age of 81. Ann Braden was one of the founding members of the Southern Organizing Committee for Economic and Social Justice, was the first person to receive the American Civil Liberties Union's Roger Baldwin Medal of Liberty. In the 50s, Braden and her husband made national headlines when they bought a home for a black family in an all-white area of Kentucky. Last year, Braden traveled to Washington, D.C. to protest the war in Iraq. She moved alongside thousands of protesters in her wheelchair. And Gordon Parks, the legendary photographer who became Hollywood's first African-American director, has died at the age of 93. His films include The Learning Tree and the 1970s hit Shaft. His photography is best known for its portrayals of poverty at home and abroad and the struggles of the civil rights movement. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from London. I'm Amy Goodman. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is in London this week for a three-day state visit. Last night, he attended a royal banquet at Buckingham Palace and is scheduled to meet British Prime Minister Tony Blair for talks at Downing Street Thursday. The two leaders are expected to discuss the shooting of Brazilian native Jean-Charles de Meneses in London last summer. Meneses was shot dead by British police in a London subway station one day after an attempted bomb attack on the British subway system in July. At first, British police said they believed Meneses was a suicide bomber. They claimed he'd run from police and was wearing a bulky jacket. But since then, it's been revealed he was innocent and that the police lied about the circumstances of his death. The Meneses family has repeatedly demanded the resignation of the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Celan Blair. They have requested a meeting with the Brazilian president, who has yet to decide whether to see them during his London visit. Lula's visit comes as the Crown Prosecution Service considers whether to charge police over the shooting. Earlier today, the Association of Chief Police Officers in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland publicly defended their policy on using lethal force against suspected suicide bombers despite the killing of Meneses. Last month, Democracy Now! Spoke with Deborah Turnus, editor of the British channel ITV News that exposed the first internal police report in the Meneses case. We caught up with her at a media conference in Doha, Qatar.
It was in the wake of the London bombings on the 7th of July last year when four men blew themselves up on three tube trains and a double-decker bus, and they killed over 50 people and maimed many, many more. Exactly 2 weeks after that atrocity, there was another attempt by suicide bombers to blow themselves up on tube trains and on a bus. But that time, those four men had a problem. Their bombs didn't explode, and so the whole plot backfired, and they went on the run. During the manhunt for those men who disappeared into the ether in London somewhere, the police shot dead a man at a tube station who they say they believed was a potential suicide bomber. They'd followed him for a couple of miles. They'd been keeping his apartment under surveillance, and they shot him dead seven or eight times at point-blank range on a tube train. He had no chance. In the wake of the shooting, the police put out information saying that he was wearing a puffy jacket and it was the middle of the summer, thus suggesting potentially that he was carrying some kind of a bomb. They said that he ran away, that he jumped the barriers at the tube station, that he was behaving suspiciously. And it turned out very quickly that all of these facts, as presented by the police, were entirely wrong, and that it was they who'd messed up and they'd shot dead an entirely innocent man. And we found out the truth of this because we obtained a copy of a leaked report that was done into the shooting. In the UK, the moment somebody is shot dead by police, the Independent Police Complaints Commission come in immediately and they start compiling a report. And it was only a few days into the compiling of that report that we received the early leak, which actually showed that it was a series of police blunders. They hadn't identified him properly. The man who was supposed to be on surveillance had gone to take a leak and wasn't even at his station. And there were lots of miscommunications. And so we put out that story. And in the wake of doing so, we have faced pressure from the police. We've been the subject of an investigation. One of our journalists has been arrested and is facing potential action.
Arrested on what grounds?
Arrested as part of the investigation over how we came to get hold of a copy of the report.
How did you get it?
I'm not at liberty to talk about that. It's extremely sensitive at the moment, and I really can't talk any more about it.
As we flew through London to come to Doha, we saw the headlines about a police cover-up. What is that about?
Well, basically, the report, the early copy of which we were leaked, hasn't been finished and completed and given to various government departments. And that has again been leaked. And it turns out that, if the leaks are true, that the officers in charge of surveillance actually falsified the documents in which they recorded their actions of that day. Now, they're perfect liberty to amend documents at the end of an operation. They go back over it and they say, oh, were we right, were we wrong? But they have to actually note where they've added stuff in. But they actually changed the essence of what they did. And in their original draft, they said that they had not identified him as a terrorist. And then later they went back and put it in that they had identified him as a terrorist. And so it all got a bit messy. And
what is the family demanding now?
The family wants truth and justice. The family wants those who shot dead their son wrongly to be brought to book, and they want to see a full legal process take place. They want someone to pay for it.
And what has been the response of the British people?
I think it's mixed, to be honest. I think while many people are outraged and horrified that an innocent man can be shot dead on a tube train in Britain, there is also a sense that this was a difficult time for the police. They were hunting for would-be suicide bombers who at any time could have just blown themselves up. And I think some people do actually have sympathy for the police and feel that actually they were just doing their best to protect us, and they got it wrong, and mistakes do happen.
I also wanted to ask you about how the British press cooperates with the government. If you could explain, especially to an American audience, this is, I think, probably a new word, the D-notice.
Yes, there's a thing that exists and has existed for many, many years in Britain called a D-notice. And a D-notice is something that is put out to the media when the government would like us to not broadcast or transmit information that would potentially jeopardise national security or the security and safety and lives of individuals. The kinds of places and times when it's used would be 2 weeks ago. There was a story from Russia alleging that British spies had been spying on Moscow, and the Russians named those individuals, and the British authorities asked us not to use their names because by exposing them we could be putting their lives in danger.
But if they were exposed already, what difference would it make? If the Russians were already, that's who would do anything, if anyone would.
Well, because by putting their names out there more into the public domain, we're increasing the risk that more people will know who they are and may act. But your point is one well made. Yeah, once it's out in Russia, if they're going to face some kind of jeopardy, then it's going to be from the people more locally, one would imagine. D-notices are also used to protect the identity of SAS officers working in the field. The Special Air Service, the boot boys of the British military who go into the most dangerous places, they're the ones that went in on the Iranian embassy siege. They were active in Afghanistan, and we filmed, in many instances, their faces, and we were asked to blur the faces because it would be a problem to identify them.
And what about this most recent exercise that they asked you to be quiet about?
Well, it was a fictitious exercise, replaying the events of Beslan in a northern college in the United Kingdom.
Beslan being the place that was laid siege to in Russia?
Yes, when all the school children were killed, when the Chechen rebels took over the school and laced it with bombs, and then the Russian army went in and the whole thing blew up, killing many, many, many children. Clearly, the British government wants to be on the front foot and wants to play out such scenarios in the UK to work out how we would actually deal with it. And in this fictitious scenario, there was a moment when the army were on their way to the location up the motorway, And the guys coordinating the media from the government side realised that we would all have choppers up and that we would be able to see this. So they discussed using a denotice to ask us not to report the fact that the army was on the way, because they know the terrorists would be inside monitoring media online, getting all the information they needed, and it would obviously jeopardise their operation. But in fact, somebody smart in that operation said, no, let's not put out a denotice, because it's not just BBC Sky and ITV News that are here. It's also Al Jazeera. And if Al Jazeera get wind of the fact that we've put out a denotice, not only will they report the fact that the tanks are on the way, they will also report the fact the British government has asked for it not to be reported. So they didn't. And in this instance, in this fictitious scenario, they actually individually approached the British media and said, we would rather you didn't report the fact that the army's on the way, hoping that perhaps Al Jazeera and others wouldn't actually get to know about it in time.
Are you experiencing a crackdown in the British press right now?
No, I don't think so. I think at times, and particularly at times when we were approaching war with Iraq, the government were incredibly active in trying to control what we said and what we did. But I think that's pertinent. It's on a story-by-story basis. I believe that things are getting harder and harder for governments all over the world, because events in London and Madrid are linked to events in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq. And you've not only got the global problem to deal with, but you've also got the homegrown terror network that we saw the result of the 7th of July. And therefore, I do think they have to tread very carefully, but they also do need to have certain controls. But I don't sense that there's a greater crackdown as such.
What about on leakers? You're the ones that are being leaked to, but, for example, Catherine Gunn, who leaked a memo, and most recently this whole issue of the new Downing Street memo. Did President Bush say to Blair that Al Jazeera here in Doha should be bombed? And now the British government cracking down and saying any outlet that publishes the actual memo will be punished, and of course indicting, charging the men involved with the leak of the memo that they say doesn't exist.
Well, my colleagues at Channel 4 News got hold of the Attorney General's advice on the war and whether or not it was legal. It was a document that we were always told we couldn't have access to. We were actually told at one point that it didn't even exist. But I think that if we believe something is in the public interest, we have to publish it. If we know the story to be true, if we know the leak to be correct, if we're handed a piece of paper or we obtain a piece of paper that tells our audience something they need to know, then I think we have to just go with it.
And more specifically, the Attorney General's memo, what did it say?
Well, it definitely suggested that he had more qualms about the legal case for war than was previously suggested by Tony Blair and the rest of the government. And therefore, it was incredibly important for people to know about it. And in my view, as I said today here, there are ethical checks and balances, there are regulations and rules, there are laws which surround us whichever way we turn. But there is always a way forward if you've got an important story that has to be told, and it's called public interest. And in the interest of the public, we have to override those rules and laws whenever we see fit, even if it means we or our journalists will face prosecution. Because if we know what we're doing to be right, we know we have a legitimate defence. And that's the thing, to make sure that your case is solid and that you can defend yourself when you do end up in the dock, potentially.
Deborah Ternus of the British ITV News, speaking to us recently in Doha, Qatar, as we continue with our International Women's Day special. Stay with us. Every day thinking about how we get through everything I own is on I owe you. But I'm here bringing y'all something new. You know, like the people, then they like you. Then they're gonna send it off with the big boo. Son in the battle, it's a son and daughter too. What you wanna talk about? Who done who? What you wanna talk about? Slang time, that's that in my A thing. I got the bombs to make you blow. I got the beats to make you bang. Slang time, that's that in my A thing. I got the bombs to make you blow. I got the
the poor, pull up the poor, pull up the poor. I'm a fighter, fighter God. I'm a soldier on that road. I'm a fighter, nice, nice fighter. I'm a soldier on that road. Bring me the reaper, bring me the lawyer. I'm a fighter, take them on. You treat me like a killer, I never hate ya. I'm a soldier on that
road. MIA, pull up the people. Here on Democracy Now!, our International Women's Day special as we broadcast from London, England. I'm Amy Goodman. A New York theater company is coming under criticism for backing out of an agreement to stage a play based on the life of U.S. peace activist Rachel Corrie. The play's producers are calling the decision censorship. Rachel was killed in Gaza nearly 3 years ago when she stood in front of an Israeli bulldozer set to demolish a Palestinian home. The bulldozer crushed her. She was 23 years old. The play is called My Name is Rachel Corrie. It's based on Rachel's writings before her death. James Nicola, artistic director of the New York Theater Workshop, said, quote, "In our pre-production planning and our talking around and listening in our communities in New York, what we heard was that after Ariel Sharon's illness and the election of Hamas, we had a very edgy situation. We found that our plan to present a work of art would be seen as us taking a stand in a political conflict that we didn't want to take," he said. Well, last night, we visited the home of Oscar award-winning actress Vanessa Redgrave and talked to her about the situation. During her acting career, it has spanned some 47 years. She has served as UN Goodwill Ambassador, was a founding member of the International Artists Against Racism. Vanessa Redgrave is one of the most famous of the legendary Redgrave acting dynasty. She started her acting career opposite her father, Sir Michael Redgrave. Her children are Natasha Richardson and Jolie Richardson, her son-in-law, Liam Neeson. Her brother, equally outspoken, is Corin Redgrave, her sister, actor Lynn Redgrave. In 1997, Vanessa Redgrave funded and narrated a documentary based on the plight of the Palestinian people. That same year, she starred in the film Julia, about a woman murdered by the Nazi regime in the years prior to World War II for her anti-fascist activism. Vanessa Redgrave won an Oscar for her performance. At the awards ceremony, she spoke out on behalf of Palestinians, an Oscar acceptance speech that's referred to even to this day. Well, last night we spoke with her at her home in London, just before she went into the hospital this morning for an operation, about the postponement of the play, My Name is Rachel Corrie.
Well, I expect your viewers know that My Name is Rachel Corrie was supposed to be opening in New York at the New York Theatre Workshop in the week beginning March the 20th. And the Royal Court Theatre, who are the producers of the My Name is Rachel Corrie, were raising money for the £50,000 that was their share of the production, and Alan Rickman had underwritten it. And suddenly, the New York Theatre Workshop said something strange over the phone to the Royal Court, like, maybe we've got to postpone this because we've consulted with a number of groups in New York City and we just don't think. And then I believe from some other emails I've had, the New York Theatre Workshop referred to contextualization, which nobody knows what that means. But the basic thing is that what's horrible about it is that, first of all, the text of this production, because it isn't a play, was taken from Rachel's diaries, and Rachel was a fantastic young American girl who any country, anybody of any faith or race should be just so proud and thrilled that the human race can produce a girl like that. So the entire text was taken, edited from her diaries by Alan Rickman, who directed, and Megan Dodds playing Rachel, and performed at the Royal Court Theatre to overwhelming critical wonder, let alone acclaim, and to all of us who went to see the play once, twice, or more. And the theatre was full of young people, full of young people who hadn't been to the Royal Court Theatre before, but had the idea that this was a play about a young girl and therefore it might have something to do with something they might care about. In fact, I was with Alan one night in the Royal Court bar downstairs, and there was loads of young girls, and of course they were all coming up to Alan and saying, well, you know, we didn't know what to expect, but this is extraordinary, because they hadn't even, some of them, been in the theatre before, any theatre before, let alone the Royal Court Theatre before. And Rachel, as anyone who's seen this production based entirely on her diaries until she was killed trying to defend these Palestinians' lives who were in this house that an Israeli army bulldozer was heading for to demolish. And Rachel knew they were in the house, and so she just stood in front of the house like all the international volunteers have been doing, and like some wonderful Israeli human rights people who I know have been doing. And the bulldozer kept coming, and her back was broken and she died. And it was cancelled, although they used the word postponed, but we all know in the theatre that if you use the word postponed, you mean cancelled. Let alone that there were jobs at stake, let alone that money was at stake. The main issue, and that is important in a blacklisting kind of time where we are, but the terrible thing was that it was silencing that girl, and she was killed to be silenced. These volunteers, they stand in, whether Israeli or American or from whichever country they were coming, in her case American, they stand in front of a house or some children or a building to prevent the families being shot at and the houses being demolished, and they call out and wave white flags. So her voice was silenced by an IDF bulldozer, a caterpillar bulldozer. But then the theatre workshop in New York, they not only then silenced her by cancelling this production, but at the end of the production, there's a little moment from a speech that Rachel made when she was 10 years old at a school ceremony. And the children must have all been told to prepare speeches about what they cared about in the world. And Rachel made this speech about world poverty and the misery that poverty causes, and her wish and desire and belief that the world could and would end poverty and that this must be done. So the New York Theatre Workshop also silenced that little girl too, who's speaking for everybody all over the world, whoever they are. It's a very, very bad situation.
So this play did not, this production did not cause controversy in London?
Oh, I suppose behind the scenes it did. In fact, I know it did, because the Royal Court Theatre were getting various letters and phone calls and so on. But, you know, I mean, that's normal. What are we all about? Supposed to be a democracy where people can say what they want and make a phone call or write a letter saying I don't agree or this is awful or whatever. But the Royal Court quite rightly didn't pay any attention at all, and the audience is packed in.
And what about the argument that in this time of, I guess they had said the Prime Minister Sharon in a coma and the Hamas election, that they didn't think it was the proper time.
Is that what they said? I hadn't read that. Is that what they said?
I think there was some mumbling about that.
Oh, well, I'm sure there's a hell of a lot of mumbling behind, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the essence of life and the essence of theatre is to communicate about lives, either lives that have ended or lives that are still alive, beliefs, what is in those beliefs. And this was an extraordinary young girl. It wasn't, she didn't take sides, although she went to defend Palestinians. It isn't about taking sides, it's about defending human life. That's the basis of all human rights. That's the basis of what every country proclaims it stands for. I don't know of a single government that actually abides by international human rights law, not one, including my own, in fact, violate these laws in the most despicable and obscene way, I would say. But to cancel a play, and it wasn't really a play, to cancel a voice, because it was her voice, is an act of such catastrophic cowardice, because we're living in times when people are quite fearful enough about speaking out for losing their career or, you know, whatever. And I think it's people in the theatre and film, radio, television, dance, music. We have to do what we must do.
Do you think times have changed since you won the Oscar about a quarter of a century ago and spoke out for Palestinians then?
Oh, yes. Times have changed, all right. The human rights movement, the non-governmental organizations, the UN agencies have got stronger and stronger. There are communities all over the world who work with human rights groups. In contradistinction to this wonderful development, you have governments that are violating human rights. Now, if you have an artistic enterprise that then moves in and opens a door for all the censorship-directed policies of any government, then that becomes a conduit for silencing of an awful lot of people who've got things to say about many other things. So I've never known, I must say in my experience, I had the support of Jewish communities, I had the support of American Actors Equity, because, you know, efforts were made to silence me along the way. And I had to, you know, go to several court cases, in fact, and I did. I sued. And it was in the suing that the truth came out.
Who did you sue?
That actually there's many more people want the freedom to communicate, as long as it's not blasphemous and destructive in a rotten way of other people, in other words, racist. I mean, those cartoons, for instance, that have shocked us all, were racist. They were fascist in character. The cartoons of the Prophet with a bomb on his head. I mean, that's a very right-wing paper, Jyllands-Posten. And it's not surprising that they published those cartoons as a sort of provocation. We've got these sort of fascist kind of things happening in the world, and we don't need any more of them. So, however, the play, because the New York Theatre Workshop cancelled, there's a producer in London, and it's going to open in London at a major West End theatre. My name is Rachel Corrie, and the press night's March the 28th. So, while every attempt is being made to suppress by governments, I think we've got that reminder of what Shakespeare said, the truth will rise, though all the earth will meet to men's eyes.
Vanessa Redgrave, the last time we saw you was in New York. You had come with a delegation and you were headed to Washington speaking out about the detainees at Guantanamo, where you were with your brother Corin, as well
as Mr. Azmat Beg
Moazan
and the
Beg's
lawyers
father.
Of some of the European prisoners in Guantanamo.
Mozambique has since been released, but many others remain. What has come of the movement that you have helped to found?
Well, we were just a small, hard-working part of it. There's lawyers everywhere, not only the wonderful American lawyers like the Center for Constitutional Rights, like the American Civil Liberties Union, but many, many big firms have poured in to assist because they're so horrified at what is being done in Guantanamo Bay. And the same is true, I would say, in a different way here in England, because we not only had a whole number of UK citizens in Guantanamo Bay, but we still have British families who've got UK fathers, brothers, sons who are held in Guantanamo. So we have a particular responsibility to free them. Long, long ago, we said, if they've done anything wrong, this is what Moazzam's father said, if he's done anything wrong, let him be brought back and tried here in the UK. But of course, they hadn't done anything wrong at all. And Guantanamo Bay was an interrogation centre where torture is practised. And when they went on hunger strike starting last August, I think there's only two or three left now, they were force-fed, and force-feeding is a torture too. And it's despicable that, in my view, that our government, the British government, has been complicit in these men being seized in the first place and then rendered from wherever to Afghanistan and then to Guantanamo.
Have you seen Mozambique since he's come home?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, and we've marched together with the mothers and sisters and wives of the Guantanamo Bay prisoners.
Shirley Booth, the wife of the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has spoken out against torture. What is your response to that?
To what? Torture? Or?
To her, the wife of the Prime Minister of Britain, speaking out. Does that surprise you?
Well, she's saying the right thing. But, you know, it's not quite the issue. She has the right, and she's exercised that right to say her mind. I haven't read that she said this, but I believe you anyway. She's a human rights QC. In practicing in the bar, she would adhere to human rights law. But we have this phenomenon in which a very strange language is being used that is the product of brains that have convinced themselves that the United Nations is an impediment in our times, that international human rights law is an obstacle, that Amnesty International, that the United Nations rapporteur on torture, that even the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louise Arbour, that magnificent Canadian who presided over the Rwanda War Tribunal, and also Yugoslavia, that these are pressure groups, was the word used by our Home Secretary in August, and are transmitting and fueling a xenophobia in Britain with various statements that are made to certain media that can be absolutely counted upon for front page xenophobic alarms and so on and so forth. It's a very, very bad time. The good thing is that there's more support for Amnesty International, for Human Rights Watch, for our own UK civil liberties organisation, which is called Liberty, than there has ever been before. Ever, ever, ever before.
Vanessa Redgrave, you also have been focusing on the issue of Chechnya, and you have made a film, Voices of Dissent. Can you talk about that?
Yes, well, this is a 47 minute documentary and based primarily on an extraordinary Soviet dissident, an absolutely heroic guy called Vladimir Bukovsky, who was one of the young people in the 60s who were inspired by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as was Nelson Mandela, as was Martin Luther King. And that generation of young Soviet people who campaigned for human rights in the Soviet Union were sent to gulags, they were beaten up in the KGB cells, that's the old Soviet intelligence services for those young people of today who don't know what that was, and who were sent to the infamous secret services, psychiatric prisons, where they were tortured both physically and psychologically. And it was thanks to Amnesty that a number of these dissidents, including Vladimir Bukovsky, were saved and brought out. So through the voices of dissidents and of Russians today, and also Mr. Zakhaev, who lives here and has political asylum here in the UK, and who was the main representative of the former President Muscardov, who was murdered by the Russian special forces in Chechnya last year. We tell in 47 minutes, thanks to Bukovsky and Mr. Zakhaev and some of these wonderful Russians, we hear their view of today and how today happened, and that the war against Chechnya was used to bring the real old KGB secret services in the military and in intelligence back into power, both in the Kremlin and in the army and in business and even in culture. And the war in Chechnya helped that to happen.
Vanessa Redgrave, Oscar award-winning actor, speaking to us at her home last night in West London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Peaceable Kingdom, a song written by Patti Smith about Rachel Corrie. Peaceable Kingdom. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast from London on this International Women's Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Millions are marking the day around the world, celebrating advances made by women over the past year, but also calling for greater equality and an end to war. In Chile, the country is days away from the inauguration of Michelle Bachelet, the country's first female president. In Africa, 2005 saw the election of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as president of Liberia, becoming the first elected female head of state on the continent. In Kuwait, women finally gained greater political rights, including the right to vote and run for parliament. But the past year has also seen a series of setbacks for women. In the United States, the governor of South Dakota has just signed legislation to ban all abortions in the state unless they're performed to save the life of the woman. And the Supreme Court has shifted to the right with the confirmation of John Roberts and Samuel Alito, both of whom oppose a woman's right to choose. In Afghanistan, women are still suffering widespread abuse, including rape, murder, and forced marriage. A new report by the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission found 38% of women interviewed have been forced to marry against their will. Afghanistan's devastated healthcare system has also resulted in the country having one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, with 1 in 10 women likely to die giving birth. In Iraq, the country's complete security breakdown has forced many women to stay in their homes for their own safety. Even female journalists have been targeted in Iraq. Reporters Without Borders is calling today for the immediate release of the American journalist Jill Carroll and Iraqi Rimzied. Carroll was abducted on January 7th. Rimzied was seized 3 weeks later. Iraq is also the focus of the Women Say No to War demonstration scheduled today in Washington, D.C. Similar protests are planned across the United States and the globe. The protest organizer, Code Pink, has said they want to revive the tradition of using March 8th as a day to gather women together to call for peace, justice, and equal rights for all. While International Women's Day is a major event in many parts of the world, it remains barely known in the United States, even though the roots of the day date back over a century. On March 8, 1857, women from clothing and textile factories in New York staged a protest against the conditions inside garment factories. On March 8, 1908, 15,000 women marched through New York City demanding shorter hours, better pay, and voting rights. In 1910, an international women's conference in Copenhagen established the first International Women's Day. 3 years later, women across Europe marked the day with peace rallies on the eve of World War I. In 1975, the United Nations began sponsoring International Women's Day. On this day, we're joined here in London by Margaret Busby, who brought us the pioneering volume Daughters of Africa, an international anthology of words and writings by women of African descent. It was published in the United States in 1994. It's a collection of women's voices spanning from ancient Egypt to the present and has been called a tribute to all black women. Born in Ghana, Margaret Busby is a writer, a journalist, an editor, critic, and broadcaster. She became Britain's youngest and first black woman book publisher when she co-founded the publishing house Allison and Busby. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
I first met you, perhaps 10, 11 years ago when your book came out in the United States, Daughters of Africa.
And this is the English edition, so you probably don't recognize it.
I don't. But I was wondering if you could begin with a quote that you begin your book with on this International Women's Day.
Well, the introduction begins with a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, who sadly died since the book was first published. This is a poem called To Black Women. Sisters, where there is cold silence, no hallelujahs, no hurrahs at all, no handshakes, no neon red or blue, no smiling faces, prevail. Prevail across the editors of the world who are obsessed, self-honeying and self-crowned in the seduced arena. It has been a hard trudge with fainting, bandaging and death. There have been startling confrontations. There have been tramplings, tramplings of monarchs and of other men. But there remain large countries in your eyes, shrewd sun, the civil balance, the listening secrets, and you create and train your flowers still. That's one of my favorites. Actually, I should tell you why the book is called Daughters of Africa. It comes from a quotation by a woman called Maria Stewart, who, in fact, I think was the first woman, American-born woman, to give a lecture, just a black woman, in the 19th century. And this is what she said in her book, Productions of Mrs. Maria W. Stewart. O ye daughters of Africa, awake, awake, arise. No longer sleep nor slumber, but distinguish yourselves. Show forth to the world that you are endowed with noble and exalted faculties. So that's a clarion call to black women everywhere through the ages.
Margaret Busby, editor of the volume Daughters of Africa. You know, in the United States, and I don't know if it's true in England, while there are a multiplicity of channels, hundreds and hundreds of channels, it seems that there is less and less diversity. Can you talk about some of the voices of these women that we are missing, names we should know about, writers that we have not read in the United States.
Well, the reason I did the book, I compiled the book in the first place, was simply because it seemed to me that people thought that beyond the three or four black women writers, normally black American women writers like Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Marian Angelou, that there had been no other black women writing through the ages or throughout the world. So I deliberately set out to include in this book not only, as you said, writers from ancient Egypt. I used some traditional African women's voices, oral history, orature, if you like. I also found writers such as from Ghana, Mabel Dove Dankwa, from... Did you know that there were African women in Turkey? There's a woman called Aisha Birkin who I bumped into and has contributed to this. There are women from Brazil, from Cuba, from Germany, from all around the world. And there are, these are African women of African descent who have things in common as well as differences. And they're writing in all sorts of different genres. And I wanted to show that there is this creativity, and there are women who have all sorts of different concerns, and they're not necessarily all domestic. Sometimes they're dealing with wider, larger issues, and they need to be heard. And that we are still in a situation where women are not always heard. And the other interesting thing, as you said, this book, we met in, 1994. This book was first published about 1992 in this country. And the number of women of African descent who've emerged since this book is wonderful. In fact, I'm currently working on a new edition. And there are writers who are still, you know, probably at school when I did this, people like Zadie Smith, who's now a really big star in this country and in America.
Another author of White Teeth, and actually in the news this week because of the Orange Prize that they're
exactly. And in fact, last on Sunday, I was part of a judging panel of the Observer magazine, did picking out the 50 most powerful people in the British book world. Zadie Smith was on it, as was Andrea Levy, who's also somebody who was not writing when this book was published. She has won, last year she won the Orange Prize, she won the Whitbright Prize, she won the Commonwealth Prize. Nobody would have thought that a black woman such as that, who you'd never heard of 15 years ago, would be sweeping the board in that way. So it's gratifying that some people are getting through.
Do you think there's a correlation between the color and perhaps gender of publishers, the majority of them, and who gets published?
Well, that is another battle I'm constantly fighting, just for diversity in the publishing industry, because, I mean, I can still go to functions in the publishing world here where I'm the only black person, let alone the black woman. So, in fact, there's an organization that has been recently started, which is called Diversity in Public in Publishing Network, which is started by a young black woman who works at Walker Books, who, in fact, was somebody I mentored when she was doing her publishing training, called Alison Morrison. And she is campaigning to get a more diversified publishing workforce, because it does obviously have a bearing on what's published, because writers, just as writers write about what they know, editors take on writers from situations that they know. So,
Margaret Busby, we're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you very much, and we certainly won't leave the issue there on this International Women's Day, for joining us in the London studio. Daughters of Africa is a book that will soon be published again. It is an anthology of African women writing. I want to thank you all for being with us. On our website, we honor today Octavia Butler in our interview with her. You can listen to and watch Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Foucault produced John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Rupert Rich, and Maddie Harper. I'm Rate, Dennis Moynihan, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.